The following program is a presentation of the Flypod New Media Network. www.theflypod.com.
Flypod.com. I'm Mark DeWitt. Welcome to Cover to Cover. Today, the author of The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism, by the winner of the Pulitzer Prize, Doris Kearns Goodwin. Doris, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Now, of course, not the Pulitzer Prize on this book. What book was it?
It was Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt and the Home Front during World War II. So it's two books ago. Three books ago, actually.
Let me ask you this. Now, people that I've talked to, it doesn't come as a surprise. Did it come to a surprise to you?
You mean getting the Pulitzer Prize? Oh, of course it always does. I mean, it's something you may dream of when you start writing, and yet you never know. There's so many circumstances, what could be out the same year, and when I found out through a phone call, it was really an exciting thing. It's just a thing you can live with for the rest of your life, you know that. So, and I loved working on that book. There was something about both Franklin and Eleanor and that period of time, World War II, that was really special, so... It took me twice as long as it took the war to be fought, but not really twice, but it takes a long time for these books.
Well, these books are thick.
They are fat.
What would you say the Bully Pulpit, about 1,000 pages?
No. Okay. It's only like 700 reading pages, but then there's endnotes and then there's an index. It's actually a little thinner than Lincoln. I was determined that it had to be thinner than Lincoln, so it is.
You know, the dream of winning the Pulitzer Prize, any journalist does that. You've been a writer for a long time. Bully Pulpit also has somebody that was striving to become something, maybe like a Supreme Court justice, huh?
No, William Howard Taft. It was so much fun for me to study somebody about whom not as much has been written. Everybody else that I've written about, whether it's Lincoln or FDR or Eleanor or even Teddy Roosevelt, have had dozens of books about him. So to discover somebody that I knew so little about, and he's a really, this is Taft now, he is, I'm talking because I think I'm living with him at the time, but he was a really amiable, kindly, gentle, fair man who dreamed all his life from the time he was young of being on the Supreme Court. He became a judge, one of the youngest judges early, and then became an appeals court judge. And then, of course, at the end of his life, after a more troubled presidency, achieves his life ambition. And when he becomes Supreme Court Chief Justice in 1921, he said it's the happiest day of his life. So I was really glad he finally got what he wanted.
You know, Doris, you mentioned that it was just like you've been living with him for a long time. Now, when you read The Bully Pulpit and you're looking at the lives of these gentlemen, it's almost like I was at that time. It was the early 1900s, late 1800s. And it's almost like the way that you describe the gentleman here, that you are, you know him.
Well, you have to feel that way. I mean, if you're going to wake up with them every morning and sleep with them at night, you have to learn about them, primarily, luckily, through the written record. All of these people at that time wrote letters. In fact, Taft and Teddy exchanged 400 letters between them. And then Taft wrote to his wife, Nellie, endlessly, probably thousands of letters. Private journals, newspaper clippings at the time. If you can catapult yourself back into that time and get as much private sources about the people and how they spoke, what their voices sounded like, how they talked to one another, then you do feel you're just sitting over the shoulder of the person writing the letter and you're really there. And hopefully that's what you can communicate to the reader. You want the reader, when they're reading, to suddenly feel themselves back in the 1890s, 1900s, walking alongside these characters.
William Howard Taft, he didn't really get out there and want to be president, I guess. Bill Clinton the other day said that he hopes that there's a lady president in his lifetime. Would William Howard Taft's wife maybe have been the first president?
It's very interesting. I mean, Nellie Taft, from the time she was a young adolescent, dreamed of having larger hopes and talents than a normal married woman might have at that time. She taught at a boys' school. Her father sent her brothers to Yale and Harvard, but she didn't have college in her chances. And she wrote in her diary she was blue as indigo because she wanted something more. But in William Howard Taft, she found the partner. He not only adored her, but he promised her that she would be his partner. And she's the one who loved politics from the time she was little. She loved going to the beer halls in Cincinnati where she could talk with working men. And she was always defying the conventions of the society life that she was supposed to lead. And when she really got involved in politics, she helped him every step along the way. When he was governor general of the Philippines, she was a really activist first lady there. She actually helped sterilize milk, which saved lots of lives and infant mortality. She brought more people into the governor's mansion there who had never been invited before because there was kind of a strict military policy against Filipinos. And then when she became first lady under Taft, she was already making a mark. So she could have been a figure in her own right. She created a municipal park in Washington where people could go for free concerts. She brought the cherry trees to Washington, and she invited more people in her guest list than most people had, and was really happy. She loved doing what she did.
No, Nellie, I think I could have enjoyed maybe playing a card game with her, too, at maybe that beer hall. Huh?
She was a card shark, evidently. She played really well, and she played for money, which was something at the time. She smoked as a young girl, which was something at the time. But I think it was all part of just wanting to be part of that man's world, which was the center of the universe at that time. She also was a very good mother to her children and a great wife to him, so the fact that she later has a stroke is just devastating to the whole story of Nellie and Will Taft.
She learned to walk again, couldn't really talk that well?
Yeah, what happened is it's only 2 months into his presidency, and I keep thinking his presidency might have been different because she was his chief advisor and she was more astute politically than he was. They were on a presidential yacht, and she suddenly fainted, having been pretty healthy most of her life, and it turned out to be a stroke. But they knew so little about it then, so they thought she'd recover. She did recover the ability to walk. She could read. She could write, but her voice mechanism was just scrambled, so she could never speak in connected sentences again. She could be taught, and he would sit and teach her to say, glad to see you or happy you're here. So on reception line, she could appear as if she were able to speak. And she could speak in a way that they would understand, but the words might come out opposite or wrong. So this voice that he depended on his whole life, people in the White House said he looked like a great stricken animal, that they'd never seen such suffering on a man's face. And so when Nellie lost that ability, in a certain way, I think he lost his... He didn't even have the fire for the job in the first place, but whatever fire it was, I think became dimmed.
Theodore Roosevelt. Now, there's a man I kind of felt sorry for in the book because a lot of things happened to him. He lost his father and his first wife. What happened to her?
Well, the interesting thing is, of all the presidents I've studied, they all seem to share having suffered adversity when they were young and come through the trials of fire. He adored his father. His father was the one, wealthy though the father was in New York, had a sense of social justice, which I think he's handed down to young Teddy. His father died when Teddy was only a sophomore at Harvard. He said that he felt like a part of his life had been ripped away. And constant activity was the way he always dealt with sadness. And then the next fall, he fell in love with a young girl named Alice, who came from Boston and said she was the first love of his life, married her, and then on a day when she was 22 years old, only a couple of years later, she died in childbirth. And then that same house, his mother was living with Alice to help her through the childbirth. She had gotten typhoid fever a week before she died on that same day. And that double loss is almost unimaginable. I mean, Teddy said he thought he'd never love again, but he went to the Badlands and his depression began to lift as he was out on his horse on a ranch. And that's where his love of the open spaces and the conservation movement really gelled. And then he came back to New York. And he had had a little girlfriend from the time he was young who had been his best friend and who was actually his adolescent partner until he met Alice. Her name was Edith. He married her, and it was a joyous, fabulous marriage. So he was, against his own idea, able to love again.
So when he went to college and left Edith behind, he falls in love, gets married. What did she think?
It was devastating for Edith. I mean, she had to put on a face. She actually went to his wedding because she was best friends with his sister. And they said she danced her shoes off the night of the wedding. But later, when they finally got together, she told him she loved him with the passion of a girl who had never loved before. And during those years when he was with Alice, her father had become bankrupt, had become an alcoholic, and so her life had crumbled in many ways. Reading was her great solace, and she was a great reader and a rather good writer. And I think she and Teddy shared that passion once they got back together. And then she became an ideal mother for his children and an ideal wife. She had no ambitions, like Nellie did, to become a public first lady. She even said when she became first lady, "I'm a private person. A woman's name should be in print only when they get married and when they're buried." So it was a very different conception of womanhood that she had, in part because of her childhood being troubled and wanting the security and sanctity of a home.
With everything that Theodore Roosevelt went through, with the many deaths in his life and people that he just loved, he seemed to be very outgoing and just probably one of the happier people. Was that more of a facade or what was it?
It's a great question. I think it was real. I think he had a temperament that withstood things pretty well and was, he once said about himself, "I think I have a happy temperament." I think people are born either with that or a more melancholy temperament. And despite all the things that happened to him, he remained optimistic and loved what he was doing. He loved being president so much. I mean, he was probably one of the happiest presidents, not only the love of the job, but he loved his family and they gave him rest and replenishment. His daughter Alice once said he loved being at the center of things so much that he wanted to be the bride at the wedding and the corpse at the funeral and the baby at the baptism. So the presidency was perfectly suited for him to be the center of everything.
The bully pulpit. I mean, where did this name come from?
He was in a conversation with somebody once, and bully at that point meant something very different from today. It meant awesome or splendid or great. He would often say when people said to him, "How do you feel? I'm bully. I'm bully." So bully pulpit meant he thought the presidency provided a platform, unlike any other political office in the country, to educate the public and to give moral advice to the public. And he said, "It's like, I feel like a preacher sometimes," he said, "but I've got this great bully pulpit." That was the first time he used the phrase. And ever since then, we've called the president's public platform the bully pulpit.
You know, I think he could have trademarked the word splendid, too.
Exactly. He had repetitious sayings that people loved. Delighted, bully, splendid, you know, speak softly and carry a big stick, the square deal. He had a genius for shorthand phrases. When you're trying to educate the country, they'll remember a slogan. He even gave Maxwell House the slogan, "Good to the very last drop." And he had a way of talking about people. He said about McKinley, "He has the backbone of a chocolate eclair." He could be tough and fiery, but there was a good-naturedness in it until later when they get into the battle in 1912 when it gets pretty vindictive. Most of the time, he was just fun to be in politics with.
Let's talk about Lincoln. Now, I know that you have a book on Lincoln out there, which was the inspiration of a movie.
It was a great experience. You know, when you're a writer, you're writing alone. And when you're part of making a movie, it's a camaraderie, a group experience. And from the very beginning, Steven Spielberg had me involved in it. I was able to take Daniel Day-Lewis to Springfield when he first agreed to be Lincoln to show him all the Lincoln sites. I worked with Tony Kushner, read all the drafts of the play, the movie, and then went down to Richmond to watch the filming of it, and then went with them to all the awards ceremonies, went with them on panels and discussing it. And just to watch a different kind of art history than I use words, they had visual understandings of how to make Lincoln walk and talk just like I knew he did. I mean, we knew that he had spoken with a high-pitched voice, so Daniel got that high-pitched voice. We knew he walked like a laborer coming home at the end of a hard day, and that's the way he walked. They knew how the White House had looked from pictures and replicated it with just loving detail. So it was, I felt like I was just watching Lincoln, the man that I'd been with for so long, rather than even watching a movie. It was so extraordinary.
I think in one of your books also you talk about Lincoln being so tall, and he put on that top hat, so he was even taller.
It doesn't make any sense to me, I know. I mean, the top, if he were, people ask me sometimes, how would he be today if he came into public life? And I've got to believe with all the changes in public life, he would still shine through because of his character, but he'd have to drop the stovepipe hat and maybe even the beard.
In the movie, since you were watching this and you went through a lot with the movie, how much of that did you see maybe in your writing? How much of that did you say, gosh, well, I do that, and I didn't realize they did that in film?
Well, I think the thing that mattered to me most was how to capture. It didn't matter what the story was. I mean, they chose a very small story to tell, which was a great idea, because if you told the broad story from 1860 to 1865 even, you would have not depth and character enough for Lincoln. But what I cared about was, did they capture that he was a man who told stories all the time, who had a great sense of humor, that also was principled but was a great politician, and that knew how to bargain and knew how to compromise, and all those things they made come to life in that script. I mean, Tony Kushner is a quite brilliant script writer, and I loved it.
In your books, I don't know about the memoir, but other books that you've written, mainly about presidents.
Oh, yeah, dead presidents are the theme, except the baseball book.
What is the challenge of doing all the research and getting that in a book to make it stand out like the bully pulpit does in your other books and to really bring it to life?
Well, the challenge for me especially is because I've chosen the most dramatic eras to write about, with good reason so many other people have as well, and the presidents I've written about have been well written about, you have to find your own storyline. I couldn't just write a biography about Lincoln or about Teddy, you know, or about FDR. And so the trouble is, it means that the process is going to be much longer because you're introducing a cast of characters to surround them. But I think in some ways, I think good history is about relationships anyway. People don't exist alone. So by having Eleanor side by side with Franklin in FDR and Eleanor, having Taft side by side with Teddy, their strengths and weaknesses play off each other and you get a better sense of them than if you're just writing separately. But it does mean in this case I was biographing not only Taft but Teddy and these muckraker journalists and Edith and Nellie. So, you know, I lived a long period of time with this one, 7 years.
Being a journalist yourself, I mean, in this book, The Bully Pulpit, you talk about the journalists, the publications that were out there at the time that have since gone away. Do you do the same thing in the other books?
Well, this one, more than any other, the journalists played a huge role, because during the Progressive Era, they say that it was primarily a reporter's paradise because they were banding together, trying to get the government to soften some of the aspects of industrialization. And they really felt they had a mission and a call, especially the group that I focused on at this one magazine, McClure's. When I was starting to read the early history of the Progressive Era, the great historians would all mention there was this magazine which somehow had an outsized influence. So I looked into the magazine and I saw all the journalists whose names I knew, legendary, Ida Tarbell, Ray Baker, William Allen White, Lincoln Steffens, were all at this one place, run by this crazy, fabulous, manic depressive guy named Sam McClure. So then they became equal characters in the book. I hadn't started imagining them at all, only starting with Teddy and Taft, and then it expanded to them.
Pictures in the book, I mean, a lot of times when you get a book like this, you have pictures kind of in the center, and you have a few, and it's like, you know, the pictures are kind of cool, the captions are great, I wish there were more pictures. What did you do in this book?
Well, there's a lot of pictures. I mean, I think it's important for the reader to be able to visualize the people that they're reading about. And so I asked them, I'd done a little bit of it in Lincoln, but not as much, that every chapter heading, it also breaks up the words in a certain sense. It takes more space, so that's the reason. And it's also more expensive for them. But every chapter heading has either a picture or a cartoon, and then two full sessions of pictures. And just to be able to see Taft and Teddy when they're young, see them as college-age people, see their wives when they're young, see them later, I think it allows you to follow through. I mean, you visualize them anyway, even if you didn't have a picture. But I love being able to see the settings, the houses where they lived, to see the... I mean, they did a funny thing at the beginning of the book. They show on the front cover Teddy Roosevelt's inauguration. It was always said that Teddy had luck, that whenever he spoke somewhere important, it would be sunny. And so you see this sunny, sun-splashed day for him, and then you turn to the back of the book, and it's Taft's inauguration, and there's a blizzard that day. And Taft had said, I always knew that there'd be a blizzard when I took over, and it seemed that every time he was giving a big speech, it would rain or snow.
Well, I'm sure that you put your thousand-word count down when there was a picture in there, right?
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Okay. You know, I want to talk about LBJ because you had a great experience in the White House, in the LBJ administration.
It really changed things for me. I mean, I would have been an historian, but I actually was studying, my PhD at Harvard was in the Supreme Court. So I might have been a Supreme Court historian. And then I got this White House fellowship to go to Washington. We had a big dance at the White House. It was during LBJ's time. You would either work in the White House or for a cabinet officer. He danced with me. He said he wanted me to be assigned directly to him. But I'd also been active, as many young people were, because I was just coming out of graduate school at the time, in the anti-Vietnam War movement. So I'd written an article against him, which came out in the New Republic several days after the dance, and the title was How to Remove Lyndon Johnson from Power. So I was sure he'd kick me out. But instead, surprisingly, he said, oh, bring her down here for a year, and if I can't win her over, no one can. So I did end up in the White House and then accompanied him to his ranch to help him on his memoirs. And I look back now and I realize to be 24 years old, 25 years old, and listening to a president, especially in those last stages of his life when he was so sad and so vulnerable. If I'd known him when he was in power, he never would have had time to talk all that time. And I realize now what a privilege it was. And I think I'd like to believe it first of all, made me a presidential historian. But more importantly, I promised myself I would look empathetically at the people that I studied and from the inner side out rather than judging them from the outside in.
So what was a true LBJ like? I mean, was he funny? He seemed almost stuffy sometimes.
He looked stuffy, but he was the last thing from being stuffy. He was profane. He was funny. He was larger than life. I don't think I've ever met a more formidable character than LBJ. I mean, and my husband worked in the LBJ administration in civil rights before I knew him, and he knew him in the glory days. And can you imagine what that big figure was like when Civil Rights Act gets passed, the Voting Rights Act, open housing, Medicare, aid to education? Had it not been for Vietnam, this man would have been remembered as one of the great presidents. And even now, historians are recognizing the level of his achievements. So when he was happy, he was just full of life and toasting people. And then he got so sad and he would hunker down and be mad at people. So there was the other side of him that I saw. But I saw him mostly partially broken by the end. And so he wasn't as tough and mean as he might have been when he was just losing that power. But he told stories. He was fabulously interesting. He never stopped being energetic. I mean, Teddy Roosevelt had more energy than anybody I know. But his was buoyed by the happiness, as we were saying, whereas LBJ's was just partially buoyed by need. He just needed to impress himself on people.
The book that you did on LBJ, a little different than the others because you had personal experience?
Yes. I mean, mostly it was based on conversations with LBJ. And also, I was still in academic life, so it was more academic and analytical than the rest of the books are. I'd like to believe more historical. I was a political scientist originally, so I had to make all these points about character and personality, because that's what you do when you're writing academically. But what makes the book come alive are LBJ talked endless hours to me, so his voice is the most important part of that book.
If you knew then what you know now, how would you have changed the conversations and everything with LBJ?
Oh, it's a great question. I think, you know, I just took for granted that I'm a young person talking to a president, and there were a thousand things I'm sure I would have wanted to ask him, and mostly he directed the conversation. It was he who wanted to get certain things off his chest, and we would argue about Vietnam. I mean, he saw me as a liberal. He called, you know, a pinko who just believes it's a little civil war over there. You don't understand the war of aggression. So it wasn't arguing, but he was countering me at all, or perception even of me. But I think now if I could just understand more about how he felt in those last years and the pride he must have felt when the great things happened. I mean, I helped him on those chapters of his memoir on civil rights, so I got part of that. But I had no idea then I was going to end up as a presidential historian, that I'd be studying presidents for the rest of my life. So I keep thinking, oh, whoa. I remember actually I had gone up with LBJ when I was in the White House to the second floor and had been there a number of times where they live. And then when I was working on FDR and Eleanor, almost all the action takes place on the second floor of the White House, because that's where he was and Harry Hopkins was and his secretary and Eleanor, of course, and Lorena Hickok and Winston Churchill. And I had wished when I was writing FDR and Eleanor that I'd asked LBJ, where did Churchill stay? Where was Eleanor? Where was Franklin? But I wasn't thinking in those terms then. So I happened to mention this on a radio program in Washington, and it happened Hillary Clinton was listening. So she promptly called me up at the radio station, invited me to sleep overnight in the White House so we could wander the corridor together and figure out where everyone had slept. So with my map in hand, 2 weeks later, I went and my husband and we went to a state dinner and then stayed up for a couple hours with the Clintons. And we went through every room and finally figured out, yes, Yes, Chelsea Clinton is sleeping where Harry Hopkins was. Bill Clinton is sleeping where FDR was. We were in Winston Churchill's bedroom. It was thrilling. So, I mean, those are the things I didn't think about when I was with LBJ, but it's really been a great privilege to be in different eras the rest of my life and feeling like I'm back in time. And each time it's like studying in college more than you could possibly do.
I know you do a lot of television, a lot of political things. The way that Washington is today, which of your books most mirrors that?
Well, the interesting thing is the larger social forces today mirror the 1900s. You know, you had the Industrial Revolution, and then suddenly you have millionaires side by side with people in tenements. You have a gap between the rich and the poor at the turn of the 20th century. You've got huge monopolies forming, and the pace of life is sped up, feeling very much like today. But the difference is that Teddy Roosevelt and the Progressive Era answered some of those problems, and they passed regulation and broke up the trusts to soften some of the aspects of industrialization. He also had a Congress that didn't want to act, but because they were conservative, old guard, Republican majority, but he was able to pressure them to act by mobilizing the public. Now we've got those same problems. We have a Congress that still doesn't want to act, but there's no seemingly easy way to mobilize the public to do something about the Washington situation. So it's a frustrating period.
Doris, if I wanted more information about the bully pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the golden age of journalism, I'm sure you have a website.
I do. DorisKearnsGoodwin.com. Yes, and it's really kept up really well, so it tells about the book and things that I don't even know about what's going on. So it's great.
Well, what's next in store for Doris?
I don't know. You know, once you finish one of these, you almost feel like you're betraying somebody by leaving them behind. Each time I had to move my FDR books to make room for Lincoln and then move Lincoln books to make room for Teddy and Taft. But I think what I might want to do is just bring all my leaders together, the people, not generally presidents, but just the ones I've lived with, and try and see what lessons we can learn from them about leadership, about life, about the way they conducted themselves. And I've learned a lot from living with them, and I think maybe if I put them together in one room or in one book, and it may not take 10 years to do that, because I know it. I just have to think about it.
You know, the bully pulpit, so much to life when you read this. Doris Kearns Goodwin will take you there. You'll learn about Theodore Roosevelt. You'll be with him. You'll be with William Howard Taft. Even there's a picture in this book, which is great. It's must be about three or four men in his bathtub. If you can have a bathtub that big, I've heard of it. I've seen it in the bully pulpit. Doris Kearns Goodwin will take you back to the turn of the 19th century.
Turn of the 20th. So it goes from the 19th. Yeah, it could be turn of the 19th, 19th to 20th. Yes.
All right, Doris, thanks a lot.
Oh, thank you very much. That was fun.
You've been listening to Cover to Cover. I've been your host, Mark DeWitt. We've been talking with Doris Kearns Goodwin, author of her brand new book, The Bully Pulpit.
To access this or other audio programming, visit our website, theflypod.com.